hppodcraft.com.
You know, my dears, that your mother was an orphan and an only child, and I dare say you've heard that your grandfather was a clergyman up in Westmoreland, where I come from. I was just a girl in the village school when one day your grandmother came in to ask the mistress if there was any scholar there who would do for a nursemaid. And mighty proud I was, I can tell you, when the mistress called me up and spoke to my being a good girl at my needle and a steady, honest girl and one whose parents were very respectable, though they might be poor, and I thought I should like nothing better than to serve the pretty young lady, who was blushing as deep as I was as she spoke of the coming baby and what I should have to do with it.
Those were the opening words of The Old Nurse's Story by Elizabeth Gaskell, depicting the origin of the titular old nurse, and we're going to discuss all her nursing ways here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're here at hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
Doubtless this narrator is going to encounter a strange, foreboding home in her new role as nurse or governess. Probably she will uncover some hideous family secrets. That's to be expected in this type of story.
Yeah.
We're talking weird sci-fi and ghostly stories by women this month, and this specific type of gothic story is a very popular one, even today. Mm. And I follow this great account on Twitter called Pulp Librarian. Do you follow
yes,
that?
I do as well, yeah.
I recommend everybody jump on board with that, and I probably mentioned it before. One of the things that comes up on that feed frequently are book covers depicting women with great hair fleeing gothic mansions. And you would not believe just how many books feature this kind of key art. It's really amazing, and you know, a lot of the illustrations and paintings are really beautiful. But it's all in the tradition of Jane Eyre and this kind of story, the gothic romance.
Mm.
And lots of these stories actually take place around your neck of the woods, likely because of the Bronte influence. I think that's really the pioneering work. Although I think this one takes place even further north.
It does, up in Northumberland, I believe.
Hey, who is that reader?
Oh, that reader is Rachel Lackey.
Awesome to have Rachel back on the show, as always. You know what? I'm going to give you a solid recommendation, Chris. You should check out the podcast, Rachel Watches Star Trek. I don't know if you've heard it. It might be a little nerdy for you, but I highly recommend it.
Do you listen?
I know you're somewhat unfamiliar with Star Trek, but just a quick summary. It's about a man in a flying saucer who loves too much.
You don't listen to the podcast, do you, Chad?
No, I've heard it. I love it. It's fantastic. That's why I'm recommending it to you. Anyway, The Old Nurse's Story is from 1852 and is considered a fine example of Gothic literature. As we mentioned last week, Charles Dickens was a huge fan of Gaskell's and invited her to publish this story in the Christmas issue of his weekly, Household Words. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure our man Lovecraft was familiar with Gaskell's work as well. I couldn't find any explicit references to it, but he was well-read in all this Gothic stuff. We got a funny comment on our Screwfly Solution episode, you know, because the comments on that, as you know, have been a barrel of laughs. Just one hilarious comment after another. So much comedy. This one was from listener Maxfield Lehman, who writes, "The author's life story is fascinating, but we don't have time to..." Oops, here we go. Is my favorite recurring segment on the podcast. And it's funny because we do tend to do that.
Well,
we got to get through this quick, and then we end up lingering. But I swear to you, we will be brief on this one because this story is somewhat long-winded.
Yeah.
So, my friend, what do we know about Elizabeth Gaskell?
Elizabeth Gaskell was born Elizabeth Cleghorn Stevenson in London in 1810. Her mother died when she was young, and her father couldn't deal with it, so he sent Elizabeth to live with her mother's sister, and her aunt gave her an education in the arts. She was married in 1832 to a Unitarian minister. She had her first child the following year, but the child was stillborn. She had four other children after that and wrote much about parenting and motherhood. She had a son in 1844, but he died in infancy. This tragedy inspired her to write Mary Barton, her first novel.
Elizabeth had settled with her husband in Manchester. That's where he was working. And I'm grabbing this from the Gaskell Society website. At that time, Manchester was at the center of great political change and much radical activity. Elizabeth observed these social tensions and used what she saw in her novels. In the preface to Mary Barton, subtitled A Tale of Manchester Life, published anonymously in 1848, Elizabeth says that she was inspired by thinking how deep might be the romance in the lives of some of those who elbowed me daily in the busy streets of the town in which I resided. I had always felt a deep sympathy with the careworn men who looked as if doomed to struggle through their lives in strange alternations between work and want.
Mm.
You know, I think she was attracted to themes of poverty throughout most of her work.
Mm.
Mary Barton had a huge impact on the reading public and provoked widespread discussion. Its subject matter, the appalling state of impoverished workers in the industrial centers of the North, and her sympathetic treatment of their plight, pricked the conscience of a nation.
It was a huge hit. She made lots of literary pals, including Charlotte Bronte and Charles Dickens. She went on to write classic novels, Cranford, North and South, Ruth, and Wives and Daughters. She died in 1865 at the young age of 55. Her house is now a museum over in Manchester, and I checked out the website, the one probably that you're talking about, and it looks very cool. It's more of a period restoration with historical artifacts than really maybe a museum, but I'd love to visit it.
I would too, man. Next time I come up there, we got to do some of that stuff.
Yeah.
That would be so fun. And then we can both flee the museum with our gray hair flowing behind us. Get a photo of that. It'll be perfect. Well, there is lots more interesting stuff about Elizabeth, but as we said, we're going to be brief about it. If you want to know more, we refer you to the Gaskell Society site. This story is a little long, so let's get to it. The old nurse's story.
Begins with our narrator, a nurse named Hester, telling a story to some children about their mother when she was a little girl. That's how the story is framed in the distant past.
Right.
It begins when the mother is a little girl and she's orphaned. Hester is her nursemaid and is given charge of taking care of the girl when her parents died. And her name is Miss Rosamund.
Right. Well, she was selected for this duty before the baby was even born. But it says, when little Miss Rosamund was about 4 or 5 years old, both her parents died in a fortnight. So she did spend time with the parents.
Yes.
But they died one after the other. It says, my pretty young mistress and me was looking for another baby when my master came home from one of his long rides, wet and tired, and took the fever he died of. And then she never held up her head again, but lived to see her dead baby and have it laid on her breast before she sighed away her life. Yeah, this is some bleak, gothic stuff.
Yeah.
Hester suddenly becomes the closest family and companion of this child, so she moves from governess to guardian. Mm-hmm. And there was a little thing in this intro that kind of made me laugh despite all the sadness. She's telling this story to Miss Rosamond's children, and she says, there never was such a baby before or since, though you've all of you been fine enough in your turns, but for sweet winning ways, you've none of you come up to your mother. I was like, man, look, Hester, I don't need to listen to the story, you know? I mean, if I was one of these kids, you're going to bag on what kind of baby I was. I got other things to do, you know? Man, I thought this was going to be a nice story about my mom.
So her surviving family decides to have Miss Rosamond and Hester sent to live up at the Furnival Manor House in Northumberland. The house is owned by Miss Rosamond's distant family, Lord Furnival, but he passed on and the current master of the house is Miss Grace Furnival. Now, Hester was very young at the time. She was 18 years old, but she tried to be very brave for her young ward. When they go to this manor house, it's situated in a thick forest.
And this is classic storytelling. The protagonist has to leave the zone of comfort and go to a new, strange, possibly scary place. It says the manor house was at the foot of the Cumberland Fells, and a very grand place, not like the parks here in the south, but with rocks and the noise of running water and gnarled thorn trees and old oaks, all white and peeled with age.
They are taken to meet Miss Furnival, who is in the West Wing drawing room. Miss Furnival is an old lady, about 80 years old. She's tall and thin, and sitting with her is her maid and companion, Mrs. Stark. Miss Furnival is a bit deaf and has a horn to help her hear, you know, like one of those old-timey, you know, that thing with the old prospector has. She says that Mrs. Stark treats her as if she's a bit of a child. Miss Furnival, not Hester.
Right.
But they don't seem particularly interested in their new ward. They're just kind of keen on their sewing and gossiping. They just kind of let her run around.
Yeah, they're living their old lady life and at first don't really care much for the kid.
So they're shown to the old nursery where they are to stay by James, an old footman. They are introduced to his wife, Dorothy, who loves Rosamond right off the bat, just takes to her right away. Hester says that James and Dorothy are some of the nicest people that she's ever known. There's also another servant under them, Agnes, who does the rough work, which I assume is rough trade is what they're talking about.
Of course what they're talking about. Yeah. Everything about coming here is strange for the both of them, but James and Dorothy immediately make them feel comfortable and at home. I actually liked that scene because, you know, when you're a kid and you go to a strange place and there's old people and you feel alienated and then suddenly there's some people you can relate to.
Yeah.
And they like you and they get along. So I also like the descriptions of the house. It says it's full of things that were curiosities to us, though they might not have been to people who had seen more. The windows were darkened by the sweeping boughs of the trees and the ivy which had overgrown them. But in the green gloom, we could manage to see old china jars and carved ivory boxes and great heavy books and, above all, the old pictures. So these are not people who are accustomed to these wealthy old manor houses. And so even though they feel a little, you know, I don't want to tell you I'm amazed by this, but I'm amazed. This stuff's really cool. You know, that's how they feel.
So in the house, we have Miss Furnival, her pal Mrs. Stark, James and Dorothy, Agnes, and now Hester and Miss Rosemond.
I want to congratulate the both of us for not making a Stark joke at this point. The Stark name comes up in a lot of stories we do. It's an easy one.
It's so easy, yeah.
And maybe I shouldn't have called attention to it even now, but I'm just... I don't know, man. I'm just proud of us.
It was hard. I really wanted to do it.
The servants love Miss Rosamond right off, but the old ladies even eventually warm up to her. It says the hard, sad Miss Furnival and the cold Mrs. Stark looked pleased when she came fluttering in like a bird, playing and pranking hither and thither with a continual murmur and pretty prattle of gladness. I am sure they were sorry many a time when she flitted away into the kitchen, though they were too proud to ask her to stay with them.
Dorothy shows Hester around, pointing out an old portrait of Miss Furnival when she was young and very pretty. She was the younger of two sisters. Supposedly her older sister was even more beautiful than Miss Furnival. There is a picture of her older sister, but it's turned to the wall and kept from the others. And Dorothy decides to be cheeky, and she's going to show Hester the picture. So she flips it over, and she is indeed very beautiful. It's a portrait, so, you know, maybe they took some liberties with the...
But she's hotter than a younger sister. Everybody knows it.
Sure, yeah. And then after she does it, Dorothy is a bit worried about showing her the picture for some reason.
Yeah, I shouldn't have done that. Why did I show you that? And of course, there are closed off sections of the house, all Beauty and the Beast-like, you know, certain places you can't go. It says there were some ugly places about the house where she should like ill for the child to go. The East Wing is verboten.
One night, after being there for a few months, with winter fast approaching, Hester hears someone playing an organ in the hall of the house. Mm-hmm. She brings that up to Dorothy. Dorothy says, nobody was playing the organ. It's just the wind. And then James comes in and goes, yeah, it's just the wind. You're being stupid. There's no organ playing. So now Hester knows that they're lying for some reason. She can just detect that they're being deceitful for whatever reason. So she decides that she's going to press Agnes when they're not around.
Yeah, it says, I tried Agnes, though I had always held my head rather above her, as I was even to James and Dorothy, and she was a little better than their servant. These status things are so crazy.
Yeah.
You know, you would think that it's this orphan kid and her governess, they wouldn't feel superior to anybody. But since Agnes does all the rough work, she thinks, well, I'll talk to her even though she's below me. But at least there's an honesty to it in these types of stories. In a way, I mean, I'm appalled by these status things, but at the same time, status categories manifest in every society everywhere all the time. It's just human behavior. Mm. People kind of know where they stand with one another and treat each other accordingly, whether it's spoken or unspoken.
She says that they hear the music only in the winter and before a storm, but she doesn't know who plays it. It may be Miss Furnival.
Folks did say it was the old lord playing on the great organ in the hall, just as he used to when he was alive. So we're talking about ghostly organ playing.
Yeah.
But who the old lord was, or why he played, and why he played on stormy winter evenings in particular, she either could not or would not tell me.
So Hester decides to investigate and goes into the hall and sees the organ, but it's old and damaged and incapable of being played. So this freaks her out a bit.
She says, I did not like hearing the music for some time after that, any more than James and Dorothy did. Of course you don't like hearing the music.
Jeez, yeah.
When you unplug the TV and the TV's still on... You're in a horror story. Get out of there.
As time passes, Miss Rosamond becomes the joy of the house. Everyone is totally getting into her.
And the nurse and the child have enough good times together that I got not to care for that weird rolling music, which did no one harm if we did not know where it came from. So somehow they have such larks that they don't really care about spooky, ghostly organ music in the house anymore.
But when they get their first winter frost, Miss Furnival says, I'm afraid we shall have a terrible winter.
Oh, dude.
Like she knows something others do not.
I wish you hadn't read it that way. Felt a little chill in my heart.
Oh, sorry. Didn't know I had it in me.
I didn't know you were going to do that. You should have prepared me.
Some more time passes, and they are in November, and Agnes predicts that there will be the first snowfall, and she's right.
The days grew shorter and shorter, and the old lord, if it was he, played away more and more stormily and sadly on the great organ.
One day, Hester is looking for Miss Rosamond. She thinks that the girl is playing a hide-and-seek game.
Yeah, that must be what it is, because it's a Sunday. Hester barely leaves this kid's side, but she wants to go to church with Agnes. So she decides, okay, I want to go to church so bad, I'm going to leave the little girl to her own devices at home. She can be away from me for a bit while I go party at the church. So when she gets back, she can't find the girl in the kitchen. She thinks she must be hanging out with the old ladies, because they don't ever go to church. That's something that's pointed out. Even though the old ladies say, we haven't seen her, she thinks this must be a game of some sort. But the girl is not around.
And Hester asks Miss Furnival, pretending not to know that Rosamond is hiding in the room, oh, have you seen her? Is she around? But
yeah,
then
she thinks it's all a game.
Actually,
it's not a game.
She's going, no, she's not here. Why are you being that way? I know you're doing a bit. It's not, she's gone. She's not here.
It's actually in the story, Miss Furnival goes, the bit you're doing is not working. Stop it.
And that freaks Hester out. So she tells Dorothy that Rosie is missing and asks if she thinks that she might have slipped into the East Wing, but Dorothy is adamant that that part of the house is locked up. So they look around and they can't find her. People start really freaking out. Everyone, even Miss Furnival, gets up and starts looking around for her.
Hester is really upset. She's barely apart from this child. It says Miss Furnival shivered and shook so much that Mrs. Stark took her back into the warm drawing room, but not before they had made me promise to bring her to them when she was found. Well a day, I began to think she would never be found when I bethought me to look out into the great front court, all covered with snow. I was upstairs when I looked out, but it was such dear moonlight I could see plain two little footprints, which might be traced from the hall door and round the corner of the east wing.
So Hester goes out into the night and follows them up into the fells.
She says that the air was so cold that the air almost took the skin off my face as I ran. I really like that specific piece of imagery.
Suddenly, a shepherd comes down from the hill with something in his arms, and it's Rosie. She's asleep and near freezing. She takes Rosie and she rubs her and she kisses her, trying to give her warmth.
He told me he had been up to the fells to gather in his sheep before the deep cold of night came on, and that under the holly trees he had found my little lady, my lamb, my queen, my darling, stiff and cold in the terrible sleep which is frost begotten. So this kid could die.
So they bring her into the house and begin to warm her up with the warming pan and put her by the fire in the nursery. In the morning, Rosie is back to her old self. She explains that she was bored with the old ladies and she saw this little girl outside. Not as old as she was, but so pretty, said my darling. And this little girl beckoned me to come out. And oh, she was so pretty and so sweet. I could not choose but go.
Shades of Salem's Lot here a little bit. The creepy beckoning child outside the window trope.
Don't like it. She went out to the girl and the little girl took her up to the fell. Now Hester is going, you're lying. But Rosie cries and says she's not lying. And Hester says, look, there's only one set of footprints in the snow. And Rosie says, that's when Jesus was carrying me.
I thought that too.
She doesn't say that. But of course, Rosie can't explain why there are no footprints because she's just a little kid. And yeah. She says it was very cold and the little girl's hand was like ice. And she took her up to a tree where underneath it was sitting a crying woman. She saw Rosie. She stopped crying and she took her in her arms and she held her snug. And then she began to sing to her until she fell asleep. She thinks Rosie might have a fever or something because this is a crazy story and very specific. And not, it doesn't really sound like something a child would make up because it's so odd. So Dorothy comes in and she tells Hester that Miss Furnival wants to speak to her. So she goes down and she tells her everything. Now, you would think she would be disbelieving or saying, oh, that's crazy, but she doesn't say that. She says, oh, heaven forgive, have mercy.
Oh, no. That sounds like a dark secret to me.
Mrs. Stark tells Hester, keep her from that child. It will lure her to her death. That evil child. Tell her it is a wicked, naughty child. Oh, have mercy. Wilt thou never forgive? It was many a long year ago. So Hester's very confused because that was not the reaction she was expecting.
No. And this is, you know, status plays into this in an important way because what choice do Hester or this girl have but to live here?
They
can't just leave.
No.
So even though there's crazy, you know, if I were living there with one of my wards, and I've had many over the years, as you know.
Of course.
I heard some crazy organ playing. Me and the kid are grabbing a cab and we're getting out of there. Doubly so if there's a wicked, naughty child trying to kill my ward in the snow.
Sure,
but
of course.
Really, the governess and the child have no choice but to stay here with all this madness.
Yeah. So after that, Hester watches Rosie like a hawk. She never lets her out of her sight.
Says, I was very uneasy in my mind after that. Of course you are. I durst never leave Miss Rosamond, night or day, for fear lest she might slip off again after some fancy or other, and all the more because I thought I could make out that Miss Furnival was crazy from their odd ways about her, and I was afraid lest something of the same kind, which might be in the family, you know, hung over my darling. So she thinks there might be just some genetic craziness going on that's even affecting the kid. And of course, throughout all of this, that organ music keeps piping up, played by nobody on a broken organ.
But not long before Christmas, just as it's getting dark, Rosie screams out, look, Hester, look, there's my poor little girl out in the snow. So Hester's like, okay, whatever. Let's see. Oh my God, yes, there is a little kid out there. Then this child begins beating on the window.
You know, I didn't like this story that much, but your dramatizations are making it really good. Oh my God.
Well, thank you, man.
You got it.
I try to jazz it up a bit.
It's working.
This child begins beating on the window panes and is seemingly crying and screaming, but they can't hear her. Rosie runs to the door to let this little girl in. Then a loud peal of organ music can be heard coming from the hall. Just as Rosie is almost at the door, Hester grabs her and carries her away, kicking and screaming. Dorothy and Agnes come in to see what's going on. Rosie starts saying that Hester is mean and nasty and won't let the little girl in. And then Dorothy's face just drains white, and she yells at Agnes to lock all the doors.
Yeah, they know what's going on. It says, she gave me raisins and almonds to quiet Miss Rosamond, but she sobbed about the little girl in the snow and would not touch any of the good things. I was thankful when she cried herself to sleep in bed. I said I had been frightened enough with the old lord's organ playing, but now that I had seen for myself this little moaning child, all decked out as no child in the neighborhood could be, beating and battering to get in, yet always without any sound or noise, with the dark wound on its right shoulder. Yeah, that's when she gets freaked out, finally. Come on, that's crazy.
That's it. So Hester hammers Dorothy to get her to finally tell her what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
But she says, and I taunted her so that she told me all she knew at last. And then, I wish I'd never been told, for it only made me more afraid than ever.
Dark secret time.
I like that. I thought that was good. So the story. Miss Furnival's father had two daughters, Maud, the elder, and Grace, who is actually Miss Furnival. He had a very high impression of himself and his daughters. No man was good enough for them.
They all have this proud streak in them. And it says he was a fierce, dour old man and had broken his poor wife's heart with his cruelty, they said. Even though he's a music lover, he's not a nice guy.
Now, Lord Furnival loved music so much that he had this musician guy come in from Europe or something. They don't really specify where.
Yeah, he's come down from London, but he's just sort of a foreigner. Perhaps he's the king of the cats. That's what I thought.
So both Maud and Grace had the hots for this guy, but he was taken more by Maud, and then they secretly got married.
Right. Maud, the older sister whose portrait is turned to the wall. So this is the scandal that set that off.
Her father would not have approved of this relationship, so she kept it totally secret. Mm. Now, Grace was very jealous of her sister because her sister was a little bit better looking than her.
And landed the hot foreign musician.
Yeah, exactly. So now the musician would go back to his country during the winter and then come back again during the summer. While this happened, Maud had a little girl, but she kept it secret, and the child stayed at a nearby farmhouse.
She pretended to be off on vacation somewhere and had this baby.
Mm-hmm.
This is a lot of story to get all at once.
Yeah.
I'm curious what Maud's plan was. I mean, obviously this was not a wise decision by a young woman to do this to begin with, because she has to do everything in hiding. But she marries the guy, she has a kid with him. He's leaving and coming back at will, not a very good husband. She can't tell her family about it. Like, how is this ever going to work out? I just couldn't understand. What's Maud's end game? Or is it just a stupid thing she did, passionate thing, and then there is no plan? You know, she's just like, I got to cover all this up and juggle. I wish the whole story was about this, because that's really, that conflict is so interesting to me.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe she was just trying to wait out her father's death and then she would reveal the child. Or, well, she's got a plan that comes out here, obviously. Her father, I guess, still doesn't know about any of this. And he just keeps playing his organ because he's really into music. So that's our ghost, I'm guessing. You know, the guy that keeps playing the organ.
Obviously, yeah.
So Lord Furnival, he got very ill over this time and he had to use a crutch to walk on. Grace and Maud had a growing resentment towards each other. That musician guy came back the following summer, but he couldn't deal with Grace and Maud being so over the top, screaming at each other, Jerry Springer arguments, breaking stuff. So he left and he never came back.
Yeah, he's a dirtbag, because even though he's secretly married, has a child with Maud, he's definitely messing around with Grace.
Right.
So she was jealous of Miss Grace, to whom her foreign husband paid a deal of court by way of blinding her, as he told his wife. Like, oh, I have to flirt with her and hang out with her so she doesn't know that we're married and have a kid. I have to do this, you know. But Miss Grace triumphed over Miss Maud, and Miss Maud grew fiercer and fiercer, both with her husband and with her sister, and the former, who could easily shake off what was disagreeable and hide himself in foreign countries. I mean, this is why he split, because of, like you said, the Jerry Springer stuff. But when it says Miss Grace triumphed, that basically means she got with him as well, right?
I think so.
What she wanted out of him. He's playing both of these sisters off each other.
So Lord Furnival got more ill, and the fighting got so intense between the sisters that they had to go into separate wings. Grace went into the West Wing, and Maud went into the East.
That's relatable, at least.
What?
I mean, that's how Heather and I deal with our problems. If, you know, if I'm mad at her, hey, you didn't do the dishes or something, I'll be like, that's it, I'm going to be in the East Wing.
east.
You go to the west wing.
I'll be in your two-bedroom apartment.
Yes. They're small wings. We can see each other from them, but you know, that's where we go.
So Maude was pretending that she was going to adopt this girl, her daughter, since her father was so sick that he wouldn't even really kind of pay attention to it, wouldn't notice.
Yeah, she's doing that thing, you know, where she's pretending her own daughter is some country bumpkin kid whom she's just merely taken an interest in. I've seen that trope pop up a few times.
Yeah. But Maude had to get in her face and said that the musician was not into Grace at all, but was into her, and that they were married and had a kid and all that stuff.
Miss Maude had triumphed over Miss Grace and told her all the time the dark foreigner had been mocking her with pretended love. He was her own husband. The color left Miss Grace's cheek and lips that very day forever. She was heard to say many a time that sooner or later she would have her revenge.
Woo. So Mrs. Stark, she was spying for Grace to find out what exactly was going on. And basically, everything comes out. Lord F is pissed about this whole secret marriage and the kid, and he's so angry about it that he kicks them out into the snow.
One fearful night, just after the new year had come in, when the snow was lying thick and deep and the flakes were still falling, fast enough to blind anyone who might be out and abroad, there was a great and violent noise heard, and the old lord's voice above all cursing and swearing awfully, and the cries of a little child, and the proud defiance of a fierce woman, and the sound of a blow, and dead stillness, and moans and wailings dying away on the hillside. Then the old lord summoned all his servants and told them with terrible oaths and words more terrible that his daughter had disgraced herself and that he had turned her out of doors, her and her child, and that if ever they gave her help or food or shelter, he prayed that they might never enter heaven. And all the while Miss Grace stood by him, white and still as any stone. And when he had ended, she heaved a great sigh, as much as to say her work was done and her end was accomplished. But the old lord never touched his organ again and died within the year, and no wonder, for on the morrow of that wild and fearful night, the shepherds coming down the fellside found Miss Maude sitting all crazy and smiling under the holly trees nursing a dead child with a terrible mark on its right shoulder. But that was not what killed it, she said. It was the frost and the cold. Every wild creature was in its hole and every beast in its fold, when the child and its mother were turned out to wander on the fells. And now you know all, and I wonder if you are less frightened now.
Ugh. Pretty brutal treatment of a child who didn't do anything.
No, God no. Or his daughter.
Yeah, I mean, she made a mistake, but to push her out into the night to die.
To die out in and the
nobody
cold?
Nobody go help her. Nobody go help her, you know?
Jesus. I would have told that guy to suck it. I would totally help her. I don't care if he's going to try and get me not into heaven.
Yeah, I know. What authority do you have, buddy?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're my boss, but I don't think you can choose that. I mean, the whole idea of the religion we have is in the afterlife, we're all equal, right? I mean, that's why we're clinging to it.
That's the end of that story. Mm. Now, we move ahead a few weeks. It's just after New Year's Eve. Hester is called to the old ladies, but Rosie's sleeping. And so she just scoops her up and brings her with her. And the old ladies are like, why are you doing that? And she's going, come on, there's that ghost kid still running around out there. I'm not going to leave this little girl by herself. You're out of your mind.
Yeah, when there's ghost kids on the loose, you got to cradle the child.
That old saying.
Yeah, that old saying. Everybody knows it.
So then Miss Furnival says, I hear voices. I hear terrible screams. I hear my father's voice.
Oh, stop that, dude. You're freezing up my heart.
So then Rosie wakes up and she can hear the girl crying and she tries to go to her, but Hester won't let her go and she struggles, but that kid ain't getting away.
I held her tight with all my strength. With a set will I held her. If I had died, my hands would have grasped her still. I was so resolved in my mind.
So the east door blasts open, and there is this light coming out of it, and a tall old man stands there, pushing out a woman and a child. And Rosie says, it's the lady below the holly trees, and my little girl is with her. Hester, Hester, let me go to her. They're drawing me to them. I feel them. I feel them. I must go.
It's sort of like our last story, where out of nowhere there's a ghostly reenactment of a horrible incident, you know.
But no way she letting go. Because she's got that kid in that Full Nelson, Hulk Hogan style. So the old man ghost takes his crutch and he goes to hit the child. But Maude takes the blow.
Well, she's trying to. You know, she's like trying to protect her as much as she can, but he lands one. That's why the kid's all messed up when we, you know, heard earlier about that wound on
the wound on her shoulder.
The tall old man, his hair streaming as if in the blast of a furnace, was going to strike the little shrinking child. Miss Furnival, the old woman by my side, cried out, "Oh, father, father, spare the little innocent child."
And at this point, Rosie finally faints.
But just then I saw, we all saw, another phantom shape itself and grow clear out of the blue and misty light that filled the hall. We had not seen her till now, for it was another lady who stood by the old man with a look of relentless hate and triumphant scorn. That figure was very beautiful to look upon, with a soft white hat drawn down over the proud brows and a red and curling lip. It was dressed in an open robe of blue satin. I had seen that figure before. It was the likeness of Miss Furnival in her youth, and the terrible phantoms moved on regardless of old Miss Furnival's wild entreaty, and the uplifted crutch fell on the right shoulder of the little child, and the younger sister looked on, stony and deadly serene. But at that moment, the dim lights and the fire that gave no heat went out themselves, and Miss Furnival lay at our feet, stricken down by the palsy, death-stricken. Yes, she was carried to her bed that night, never to rise again. She lay with her face to the wall, muttering low, but muttering always, "Alas, alas, what is done in youth can never be undone in age. What is done in youth can never be undone in age."
That's the end of it.
That's the end of the story.
Kind of the theme, right, at the end? What you do in your youth, you can't undo later. Is that profound or kind of just a simple concept?
I don't know, because there are things I think all of us do in our youth that we have regrets about.
I guess that's what it is. It's an expression of regret.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what this story is about, because even though it's about the old nurse's story, the real central figure is Miss Furnival, you know.
Yeah.
She allowed this to happen to her sister and the poor child. And regrets it and is visited by this ghost to remind her of that injustice. You know, that last one we read was just a very simple ghost story. I think it was about an effect. It was like, let's create a spooky atmosphere and then have this large Marge kind of thing happen. Whereas here, it's at least trying to get at the nature of a haunting, you know, as it relates to how we're all haunted by past deeds or misdeeds, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's something actually going on here, which is through jealousy. But although, you know, it even feels unjust, because I feel like these two girls got totally... They had a crappy dad who mistreated them. And then this dude swept in and kind of charmed them both. I mean, they have some agency in that they were fighting amongst themselves about him. But societally and status-wise, they didn't have a lot of choices in their life.
No.
And like, you know, even Miss Furnival, for being kind of crappy to her sister, I still don't... I don't feel like she's really that much at fault for what happened. I mean, it was the man who came and struck that child.
Oh, yeah, of course. It was just to her being the person that wanted it to happen. And when it was going on, she was happy. She was like, she's finally getting hers. And seeing that kid get hurt made her feel better, because she knew it was hurting her sister. And then later on, as she gets older, she realizes that that was messed up and wrong. And But, you know, you can't change the past. You can only hopefully learn from it and move on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there you go. This story's... it's very long-winded and it was hard to get through. But maybe if you want to come see my one-man show, The Old Nurse's Story.
Oh, man.
That's coming out June 13th.
Oh, excellent. That's soon.
Next year.
That's like...
Next year.
Oh, next year. Oh, okay.
Next year. No.
Well, I mean, look, you were sight reading a lot of these lines in here.
I know.
And honestly, I don't think you should do a one-man show, because you already nailed it. Like, why even bother? You're like Mozart with this stuff. I don't even know, you know.
It's true.
I have to go to the doctor now to get my heart defrosted.
Wow. Shit. I'm sorry. I did not mean to do that.
See, now you have something to regret. This is your ghost story, actually.
You know, something I don't regret is having Rachel Lackey read this stuff.
I don't regret it at all, man. She's great. I love listening to her. She does such a good job. And again, please go check out her podcast, Rachel Watches Star Trek. Specifically, you should check it out, Chris, because I think you really like it.
Yeah, you really need to listen to it, Chad.
Hey, you know who else I want to thank? I want to thank a few patrons.
Oh, I love our patrons. They're the best people in the universe.
Can I say some of their names? Would that bother you if I did that?
No, please.
Okay. I want to thank Ellen Johnston.
I'd like to thank David Hennion.
I'd like to thank Roland Blackburn.
I'd like to thank Harry Frankie Hess.
I want to thank Samuel Martin.
Hey, Brad McLean. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew Tansek.
I want to thank Steve Kirkham.
I'd like to thank Gateless Gate Studio.
And I would love to thank Chris Martell. Thank you so much, Chris Martell.
Thank you all for tuning in. That's all we got for now. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.